This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When journalist Theopadnos sneaked across the border from Turkey into Syria, he thought he'd be able to get some stories that were difficult to access through above-board channels. Instead, he was walking into a trap.
I was like a homeless journalist traveling around. I have SIM cards from like 25 different countries here.
I was going to follow some refugees back into Syria, and I was going to write about the adverse conditions in the camps.
And I thought, I'll write a lovely piece for the Republic, and my journalism career will prosper. And then without really thinking about it, I stood up and walked down and went to meet the people who kidnapped me at the hotel.
That's right, kidnapped. That's Theopadnos. His almost 2 years of captivity within Syria are retold in a new documentary called Theo Who Lived. It was recently shown in Burlington. And Theopadnos joins us today to talk about his experience and what he learned from it. Theo, welcome to Vermont Edition. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
So at the time when you were kidnapped, this particular part of your story starts in 2012, and you were a freelance journalist with a lot of experience in the Middle East. You'd studied Arabic and Islam at several religious schools in Yemen and Syria. And as I understand it, you had moved to Turkey in the aim of getting Western publications to hire you to write stories about what was happening in Syria at the time. What exactly was it that you wanted to write about that you felt wasn't being covered?
I mean, at the time, even in 2012, they were slaughtering one another, and there didn't seem to be any end in sight, as there kind of almost does now. And I thought that I could shed light on this conflict by writing about the religious feelings that circulate in the places, you know, in the landscape itself. Not everybody believes in God in quite the same way, although God is much more present in Syria than he is in Vermont, for instance. So, you know, I have studied the Sunni religion. I studied what the Alawites kind of believe, at least the regime. To be an Alawite is to be a member of like a secret sort of sect. So they won't tell you really what they believe. But, you know, you can read and ask. And because I speak Arabic and I have relationships with lots of people who are involved in the conflict or who were being sort of swallowed up by the conflict, even in 2012, I thought, okay, I have a unique perspective and a good ability to write about it. And it shouldn't be any problem. And I'll just walk down there, get some good stories and no problem.
Why weren't Western publications hiring you to begin with, even before this?
Actually, it's a good question. Mostly the answer is that the editors are dummies and they don't know. No, really. It's true. Not all of them are dummies. You do your best. You say, listen, I got this great story. And they go, that's really good. I have to go to this lunch in Manhattan and I'm not interested. Goodbye. Mm-hmm. You know, mostly it's that they have to fill up their magazine with like 20 million different things. And sometimes they're just not interested in the thing that you're offering. Even though you think it's interesting, they're like, I got other stuff. Goodbye.
So
I think it was basically that. It wasn't because I was bad or they were bad. It was just because they were pursuing some other agenda at the time.
But you were still
also.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Also, I maybe accepted defeat too readily. Like if I got a couple of rejections, I go, forget it. I'm just a loser, you know?
Yeah, but it doesn't
sound
like
attitude.
You had sort of accepted this rejection because here you are in Turkey and you're thinking, I can still get these stories. And, you know, it's almost like you were going to do them on spec. Like, I'm going to do these stories and they're going to be powerful and somebody will want to read them.
That's true. That is what I still do. I believe that it's probably best if you do it on spec because, you know, you go in with like an open mind and you say, anything that interests me, I'm going to make that interesting to a reader eventually, but I'm not going to follow some guy's direction who's sitting in the office in New York or Washington or London or Australia, God knows where. He doesn't, you know, I just felt that I could do a good job if I went and wandered around on my own. Of course, I was wrong.
Well, yeah. Tell us about how you got hooked up with these men who turned out to be your kidnappers, but you thought were going to help lead you into Syria and to the stories that you wanted to do.
They certainly did lead me into Syria. I mean, the situation at the time, I think it might still be a little bit this way. In Antakya, a border city, formerly Antioch, it's on the Syrian-Turkish border. The situation there was that fighters from the resistance armies would come to this little town, Antakya, to recover from their injuries and to buy supplies, and then they would return to the war zone. There was, you know, like a tremendous amount of back and forth traffic all through illicit routes across this border. And I thought, furthermore, there were a bunch of journalists that were traveling with these fighters. And I thought, you know, because the U.S. is basically on the side of the resistance and against Bashar al-Assad, they're not going to have a problem with me because of my nationality. So, like a dummy, I did not conceal my – I didn't try to tell people, listen, I'm not American. Sometimes I say I'm French or I'm German or Russian. No, I can't say Russian. I say French or German or some other language I can speak and pretend. But I was so confident in myself that I go, oh, no, I'm American, no problem. And that was a huge mistake.
Because why?
It would be a mistake. You cannot be in this part of Syria. To be an American is to be an enemy of the people, of religion. You know, they held me responsible for the slaughter of millions of Iraqis. Now, that they believe that millions of Iraqis died in the war that George Bush initiated in 2003. Now, I don't know how many civilians or combatants died. I wasn't in a position to dispute their statistics. I didn't have, like, Wikipedia available. Anyway, they believe that America is responsible for them, like a large-scale mass murder of their friends and neighbors and families. And they held me responsible for these crimes.
So these men that you had been going into across the border with, and in the hopes of being led, across the border to where you wanted to go, they kidnapped you. And can you explain the family tree here between the Free Syrian Army, Al Nusra, Al Qaeda, so we can understand who held you captive?
Right, and ISIS plays a role in here. I mean, at the time, the rebels, at least in theory, were one big happy family, and they all got along, and they're all pursuing the same objective, which was the removal of Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria. And you know, they had certain ideological differences and certain, like, temporary strategic differences. For instance, the Al Qaeda people generally want to have a religious war that will privilege, in the end, the believers, the Muslims, at the expense of people who don't believe, who they call kuffar, or unbelievers. So that's one faction. Another faction is in this violence that's occurring over there is regime soldiers who have defected from the official army and taken a lot of weapons and equipment. And that's kind of like a theoretically a more secular sort of branch of the rebellion. And then there's, at the time, in October of 2012, when I went into Syria, there were just the beginnings of some issues between the Iraqi branch of al-Qaeda and the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. And they were just beginning to have some arguments. And eventually, this argument developed into that split between ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, or al-Qaeda, which still is in effect today. They still don't like each other. But tomorrow, they may decide that they're friends again.
And at the time, so you were this is an oversimplification, but basically you were captured by the Free Syrian Army and then handed over to al-Nusra, which at the time was basically al-Qaeda's arm in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, that is one way to say it. Another way is some men who were very angry at what we had done in Iraq decided to blame all of their life's miseries on me. And they gave me to other people who did the same thing. And these people, the reason why I'm being coy or vague about this is because they change their allegiances every day. It's like, today he's Jabhat al-Nusra, tomorrow he's Free Syrian Army, the next day he's Daesh or ISIS. It's like their allegiances, the names of the groups are much more important to us than they are to them. And I know this because so many of the guys that I was in prison with had previously, they were like Jabhat al-Nusra guys that went off to fight for some other group, like Daesh, ISIS, or the Free Syrian Army. And my group, Jabhat al-Nusra, didn't like this because they wanted their own guys to stay with them. So they put those guys who had become ISIS guys, like, in my jail.
We're talking with journalist Theo Padnos today. Yeah, no, Theo, you're great. He's telling us about his experience being taken hostage in Syria and imprisoned for 2 years. And Theo, I stopped you because I want to invite our listeners. If you have a question for Theo, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions and thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Theo, I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, I can't remember what I was going to say. Sorry.
Well, let me ask you this. Can you describe the physical conditions that you were held in, including the fact that you were tortured throughout much of the 2 years that you were held prisoner?
I mean, one thing I can say about the torture is that what they subjected me to is like nothing compared to what they're subjecting their fellow citizens to. I survived this, and I'm, like, totally fine now. I ride my bicycle, I can ski, I can play tennis. I'm fine. But many people come out crippled for life. And that goes for the people in the regime jails and the people in the opposition jails. It's like a systematic thing. Whenever you come in, anybody who comes into any Syrian jail, like the first night, you have what they call a reception party, which is torture. It's very unusual. If you go to a jail, there is no reception party. You're like, well, thank you. you know, it's a very violent conflict, as you know, and the emotions are running high. And the first thing they do when you get to a new jail is to just beat the living daylights out of you so that you know who's in charge. And if you doubt it, they go, you want any more? And you go, no, please. Then they give you a little bit more. Then you know who's in charge.
And that happened all the time.
A lot. You know, it happened a lot. But eventually they decided that I was okay and they weren't going to – I think they continued to believe that I was some kind of American spy. But eventually they were like, well, he's a spy, but now he regrets it. Or anyway, you know, it was all in the past and let's move forward. You know, they're like, let's move on.
You just said
you asked me about the conditions of the confinement. Yeah. I mean, at first I was in a hospital in Aleppo. Like for 4 months I was in the children's hospital, or no, I think it was the eye hospital right next door to the children's hospital, recently been recaptured by the regime in the last couple of days. And, you know, this hospital, the rebels were taking the plumbing out of the wall and using this to hit the prisoners with. They were like, they had turned this thing, they were burning up the doors and the windows of this thing to use to like heat the, their tea with, cause they need to have tea. It's important in Syrian life, especially in the morning. Like this time of year, it's really cold, so everybody likes to drink warm tea. And they couldn't be bothered to like use the existing heating system. Maybe it was broken a little bit, but they didn't feel like repairing it. So they just ripped the plumbing out of the walls. There's been so much written about all the hospitals that allegedly the regime is bombing, but not all the hospitals really are hospitals. I mean, some of them are prisons and torture chambers. Not all the doctors are doctors. You know, I dealt with many doctors, or not many, but some doctors over there. Clearly to me, they were not doctors, not bound by any kind of Hippocratic oath.
You said a minute ago, though, in regards to the time that you spent as a prisoner and the physical abuse you suffered, that you're fine. You can ride your bike. You can play tennis. Mm. But, you know, those are physical scars and those are physical wounds that healed. I can't imagine that the psychological and mental scars are as easy to heal.
I don't think that they didn't scar me in a mental way. And it wasn't because I was tough or anything, but I knew what they were trying. I knew, listen, they are changing the psychology of the people over there. That is certainly underway. But I knew how they were trying to change my psychology. And I knew basically what was happening. Perhaps they did a little bit. I was willing to give them, you know, I was willing to at least, you know, play along and say, okay, I'm with you. I support your cause and I respect the things that you guys respect. But in my heart, I was like, no, I don't. Remember Kayla Mueller, who was killed, was held by ISIS and was killed either during a bombing or perhaps before or perhaps mm-hmm. after these mm-hmm. bombings. But she was a 26-year-old aid worker. She wrote home to her mom and dad. She goes, no, that, you know, on the inside, I have not given up. I will not give up. You know, and when I read that, I'm like, Kayla, I'm so with you on that. Because for me, that's the way it was. It was like, you guys can have my body. You can do what you like with it. But on the inside, I'm not going to give up to this dumbness, this stupidity that you're inflicting on me. I was very, you know, offended by, well, everything. But I was offended by, like, the way that they wish to bring you into submission. You know, it's something they do with their children, something they do with the women a lot. And, you know, I wish I had gotten to know the women more. And I'm delighted now. I'm in Germany now. when I meet women that come from those places where these men are, I'm so like, want to just hang out with them and know them more and kind of just be with them, because I feel that we went through the same nonsense together in a way. And we couldn't talk about it at the time, but now that we're both free and out of the danger, we can talk about it. So it's good in that respect. It's like therapeutic for me to hang out with these people.
Well, I really appreciate that you're talking to us about it today and sharing your story. We're talking with journalist Theo Padnos about the 2 years he spent imprisoned in Syria. And if you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We'll be right back. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with journalist Theo Padnos. In 2012, he crossed into Syria from Turkey with a plan to interview rebels fighting to overthrow Bashar al-Assad and tell other stories from within Syria. Instead, he was kidnapped and imprisoned and held by al-Nusra for nearly 2 years. He's made a documentary about his experience, and he's our guest today. And if you have a thought to share or a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Theo, you mentioned that you never felt like the mental torture was having the desired effect on you or that your spirit wasn't broken. But I understand you tried to kill yourself. So what were you thinking at that time?
I mean, that wasn't a question of them breaking my spirit in a way. That was my defiance of them. Because they had really convinced me, you know, I didn't know them well enough, perhaps at this point, to know that this was just a scam. It was like a transparent sort of, not transparent, but a ploy to get me to give up on life, which is what they want you to do. I really did give up on my existence in among the living, and I was okay. I was like, I have lived a beautiful life. I went to a beautiful college in Vermont. I had a nice life there, and I had a, you know, beautiful family, and I was like happy that I had lived, but I was ready to leave. The reason why I was ready to leave and just sort of make my peace with life was because I was so persuaded they were going to kill me under torture. And I'm like, I don't want to give them this victory. Why? So I tried to hang myself in the prison. People do this. People do this in these jails.
Yeah, I imagine they do it more often than we hear about.
I'm sure they do.
I'm asking you really personal questions, and I understand that, but you've actually also gone back to Syria. You've essentially retraced your steps as best you could. You've sort of recreated your experiences and not held back, and it's all in a documentary film called Theo Who Lived. Why do you want to, I guess, share this part of your story with everybody and allow people like me to ask you very intimate questions?
Mm-hmm. I don't think those are that intimate questions that you're asking. I mean, I think you're saying, gee, what happened? Who are these people and what's going on and how did you feel? I don't feel that that's, I mean, to the extent that they did something, they violated a very, like, my body, you know. They had my body in their control, but they didn't have my mind. So perhaps if they had had my mind, I would feel that it was more intimate violation. But they just had my body. They just abused the physical part of me, and it got better. So I'm kind of like, I don't feel traumatized by that or anything. I'm sorry, I forgot the important bit of your question.
So why did you want to make this documentary?
Why do I want to go back? I didn't go back to Syria in the first place, but I did go back to Turkey, to Antakya, and I did go back to the Middle East. We filmed in Israel, and the reason why I would, like, my priority right now is to help people in the world better understand what is happening in Syria. Some very strange and unusual things that haven't happened in 1400 years of Islam are happening. Like, they're smashing up the ancient cities, they're throwing gay people from the towers, or allegedly gay people, they're shooting people because of their political opinions. It's just a very strange kind of religious atmosphere of violence and piety and terror that has swept across the countryside. So I'd like to make people understand how dangerous this atmosphere is, because it can export itself through the internet. You know, I have been living in Paris a little bit since my release, and both of those attacks that occurred in Paris occurred like within a kilometer of the apartment that I live in. So I'm quite aware that there's craziness that's happening in Syria quite easily exports itself or communicates itself through the internet. And also, it's a big magnet, you know. Young men who feel that they would like an adventure or spiritual, you know, something, some kind of spiritual adventure, are leaving. And young women, by the way, leaving the West to go off and have their spiritual adventure among the Jabhat al-Nusra people or the ISIS people. And I just find this a very interesting phenomenon that I would like to discuss more and have people better understand.
Well, let's go to some of our listeners. Charles is calling in now from South Burlington. Hi, Charles. Go right ahead.
Hi. I really like the story of your guest here, but I'm curious to ask him, why do you think the United States finds it necessary to involve in a civil war in Syria, and now basically a proxy war with Iran and Russia there? I mean, let's face it, we've had our own civil war. We rebuilt, and we became a great nation. We've had civil wars all over the place, in Spain in the 30s, and Yugoslavia in the 80s and 90s. So that's my question. Why is it necessary for the United States to be involved over there?
Charles, thanks for the call. Theo, what do you think?
I think that we could have a very productive and useful involvement in that we care about our fellow human beings, and we want to rescue them from mortal peril. I just think the way we're doing it is horrible. We're sending them more guns. We go, oh, here's a neighborhood that's completely destroyed and shot up, and we're sending them weapons that we would never allow on our streets. We go, oh, go ahead, take this TOW missile system. Maybe it'll be good. Go off and kill some more people. Maybe that'll be the right thing for you. I mean, this is what our diplomats in their wisdom have decided to do. So I'm definitely against that. It's a country that doesn't need any more weapons. It's like needs fewer weapons and peace. But I'm all for humanitarian interventions. If that's just something that we can pull together and agree we want to do, we want to save like women and children. The children are being bombed and, you know, like murdered in the streets. Would we really feel good about ourselves if we just sat by and let this happen forever? I mean, that's kind of like that. They're in a way they would keep going if the outside world didn't step in. So I think we have an interest in stopping. Also, you know, we don't want to see terror exported to the West.
We can't seem, though, to all agree on the right way to deliver humanitarian aid and how. And, you know, even the countries that are supposed to agree, we haven't been able to do that effectively or to stop the slaughter.
Yeah, I mean, it is seem to be, it's at least in Aleppo, it's coming to an end. I assume that it will continue. It will only continue to the extent that these guys have bullets to put in their guns and guns to shoot at the other people. You know, as soon as we stop sending them bullets, they're going to run out, and then they won't be able to shoot other people anymore. So it's like a gun control issue. Stop sending them these guns. Like whatever it is that the rebels are fighting for, I think they can get it. Get a lot of what they're fighting for if they just talk it out. That's what the regime has been saying to them in the beginning. Like, would you guys be willing to talk? And they were at first willing to talk, but suddenly, not suddenly, but gradually, they began to get more and more guns and more cooler and newer guns and trucks and equipment and cash from across the world. And they're like, gee, what should we talk for now? Because we get some cool trucks to drive around in and some great guns and missile systems and rockets, and let's use these. That's how things got worse.
Let's go to Joan, who's calling in from Facetown. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm just wondering if anyone in any administration or office in our government, our fine government, who I agree with you caused all this issue, has reached out to talk to you at all.
I do talk to the, I have some contacts in the FBI, and they're like responsible for my case because I'm a victim of terrorism and they're prosecuting or trying to prosecute the criminals, I think. I'm not really sure what the status is, but, you know, maybe they'll try people in absentia. I'm not quite sure, but, is the U.S. government, are they interested in my opinions? Maybe. I mean, I have to write intelligently and publish in a prominent place, and I'm sure they will pay attention or, you know, Actually, we have a new government coming in. I think those people are like crazy, so I doubt they will pay any attention. But I have confidence in the Obama people that if you make a persuasive argument to them, they're capable of listening and, you know, and making a wise decision. They just haven't had good intelligence. You know, they don't know what's going on, so they assume that they have to do what they're being told to do, like send more guns. But, of course, this is not what they should do. It's really a function of their poor intelligence, like the journalists don't understand and the intelligence people don't understand.
So are you speaking with them about what you understand, given your experience and your knowledge of Syria?
They're not asking me policy issues, no. They're like, can you give us any info about Abu Hamza or Abu Muthanna? And usually I can't because it's like 2 years old. So no, they don't say, oh, Theo, wow, you know so much. Why don't you help us understand what to do in Syria? That is not that's not happening.
Just can you tell us how you got freed?
Yeah. One day I was sitting in this beautiful diwan sort of living room in southern Syria outside of a city called Dera. And I had been like promoted through the ranks a little bit. I wasn't any longer terrified and lying on the floor in my cell. Instead, I had been made like an honorable prisoner, sort of almost a guest. And why this was, don't really know. Maybe maybe they knew that they were somehow, this group Jabhat al-Nusra, that they were going to improve their position by giving me back. So, I don't know if they got cash or they got, weapons, but they got something. And, as soon as they got this thing that they wanted, they let me go. I really don't have any more details than that. I was sitting in this room and all of a sudden the chief of Al-Qaeda came in. He goes, I'm going to send you back to your mama today. I thought they were going to take me out to the desert and kill me. I didn't have a whole lot of trust in these guys. But instead they drove me backwards and forwards, up, down, over, backwards, forwards. And eventually we arrived at the Israeli border and they let me go.
What was the first thing you said to your mom when you saw her?
I said, Mom, I wrote this beautiful novel about Vermont. And she goes, she's like, I mentioned some of the people. They're from my hometown. And I didn't change their names in my book.
This is a novel that you wrote while you were held captive, and you wrote it on an old calendar that you'd found.
Yeah. And I was like really proud that I had written this novel. I still am. It's an interesting book. It's about, how a society can give itself over to a strange social movement that is very destructive and violent, and it doesn't appear that way in the beginning. It appears to be something that's possibly good. Anyway, I wrote this novel, but I said it in Vermont. It's kind of about the arrival of a season of craziness in a small town. And I wanted my mom to know about this book, so I told her, and she's like, "Well, you can't use that name; we'll get sued." So I'm like, "Mom, I'll change the name. Don't worry. Just focus on the novel."
and have you published it yet? Have you gotten anybody to publish it?
No, I have to finish it. I have to transcribe it from all the jail, little pieces of paper that I collected. And then I have to, publish it. It's going to take a little while.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to it. Theo Padnos, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you very much.
And the documentary about Theo's experience in Syria is called Theo Who Lived. Coming up, Victor Jara may not be a household name here, but he certainly is in Chile, where his musical and political legacy continue to reverberate. We'll talk with the Vermonter who's behind a new documentary of the folk hero next. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Take a listen to this trailer for a new documentary film and see if you can identify any of the voices you hear.
He was a Chilean leader, a musician, a director.
Great songs, beautiful melodies.
He's an originator.
Victor Jara was the Bob Dylan of South America.
Victor saw the power of music as this vehicle to communicate.
His music is a loving battle cry.
He was a fighter.
He followed through on the issues he sang about.
Pete Seeger and Bono are in there, so are Peter Yarrow, Holly Near, and Devendra Banhart. The man they're talking about, the subject of the documentary, may be less familiar to many Americans. Victor Jara was a Chilean songwriter, activist, director, and poet. After Chile's right-wing coup in 1973, Jara was tortured and killed. But he and his music became a powerful symbol of hope in Latin America and beyond. The new film about him is called The Resurrection of Victor Jara. John Suma is the film's producer and a lecturer in economics at the University of Vermont, and he joins me now. John, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So familiarize our audience with Victor Jara.
Well, Victor Jara has parallels here. We can draw North Americans' attention to. That would be Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan. He's sort of a rolled up version of
yeah,
of
he's
all
far
of them.
More than the Bob Dylan of he's South America.
He's much more
America.
Political than Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a writer as good as Bob Dylan.
And was he as well known in Chile in the late 60s and 70s, early 70s before his death as those people you just mentioned?
By those people?
No, I mean, was he as
oh, yeah,
you know,
he became an iconic singer-songwriter and defined an era at that time. The 60s, early 70s would be Victor Jara songs played everywhere. So there were other artists around, but Victor became a leader of this movement that's known as Nueva Canción, which is new song. It's a folk revival that they had. We had here our own folk revival in the 60s. So that was their folk revival, and he was the leader of that movement.
He also was active, though, in poetry, in theater. He was a director, so he did much more than just music, right?
It's an amazing story. He comes from a poor rural family, ends up on Broadway staging a play in 1967, which had a successful run, Body Party. Directed it to become really the voice of Latin America and the voice of his generation musically. So that's quite a trajectory. And then the tragic end, of course, which really sets up his rebirth as this film we've made documents.
Why was he targeted by the military junta in 1973 when Augusto Pinochet came to power?
Well, anybody supporting Allende at the time, the elected president who was deposed in the coup, was subject to, persecution or political execution. So there,
and he was a
leader.
A very
he
vocal
was a leader.
Supporter.
So he was a very outspoken leader, a supporter of Allende through his music and a cultural leader. You know, so they decapitated the popular movement, and the leaders of that popular movement included cultural figures like Victor Jara.
And he was picked up on September 11th or September 12th when this coup happened and taken to a big stadium in Santiago, the capital of Chile, and tortured and killed there?
Yeah, essentially he went to where he taught to be with the students, and that led to him being detained, among others, and then taken to the stadium, which is not the National Stadium. It's often misunderstood. It's a smaller stadium, a basketball stadium, now named after Victor Jara, Estadio Chile, now Estadio Victor Jara. And that's where he was detained and held tortured for several days and then eventually executed.
What was
or we should say murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the response in the country when people learned of his death?
Well, people for the first year or two or more than that time, there was so much fear. If you were caught with any Victor Jara music, you might be yourself disappeared, tortured and or disappeared. So I don't think anybody did too much talking. If any talking was going on, it was very secret. It was, there was.
So there was no outward, outpouring of emotion. Every
aspect of his life, musically, culturally. There was an attempt to erase the memory banks.
Your film, though, is called The Resurrection of mm-hmm. Victor Jara. What does
yep.
that mean?
Well, it's a way of saying that he was a transcendental figure. He transmits across generations, continues to do that. The film shows that very vividly in the scene from his reburial in 2009, which is a celebration, really. But it's the first time that people can come out and express that love of his music without fear of persecution. It's really the first outpouring. And it's 2009. This is quite a bit beyond the end of the dictatorship, there's still that residual fear, you know. So it was cathartic, and we document that. That's the most emotional part of the film, is that segment that covers the reburial.
Well, describe it and explain why his body was exhumed and he was reburied in the same place where he'd been buried. But yes, this procession and parade and this outpouring that couldn't have happened in 1973.
Well, it's tied to a court, the legal proceedings to seek justice for Victor Hara. So the judge ordered his body exhumed. And so that's why the body was out of the ground, and then
to try to figure out what had happened,
autopsy,
to him.
And you know, to corroborate the testimony that was given in court, and we don't go into the case in the film, but we do have a coda, a tale to the film that does speak to the latest developments in the case. I'm not going to give it away on air, as you probably know if you saw the film, but this court case is not in the film, but the exhumation of Victor is tied to that court case. So the reburial happens after all of that necessary autopsy work is done, and the Hara family really, you know, gave Victor to the people. That's it.
What do you think his legacy is now? I'll tell you, I lived in Chile in 1999 and then was back in 2002 or 2001. And, you know, there is a sense of him and some of the other people who were active in the movement at the time, people like Violeta Parra, are alive in Chile. I mean, if you're riding a bus and a panhandler comes on, that's the music they're often playing. And that's the reference that folk groups even today make, is back to Victor Jara. So what do you think he means in Chile and to the people there?
Well, the best way to describe it to a North American audience is to think of us here growing up as great school kids listening and singing the music of Woody Guthrie, "This Land Is Your Land," and other songs that he's done. But that song particularly captures the presence of Woody Guthrie, the transcendental Woody Guthrie. And it's exactly what's going on in Chile. The school kids are now all singing Victor. They're singing songs in grade school. It's become embedded really in the cultural memory banks. This is part of the resurrection, part of the rebirth of Victor. It's reached that degree of cultural presence, yeah.
How did you get involved in this, and what made you want to tell his story?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have another show we could do on this question. 35 years of engagement in Latin America that led me to do my first film about the Contra War in the 1980s, which I produced and directed in 1986. Which got favorably reviewed by the New York Times, by the way, the late Herb Mitking. And that film just immersed me in the music and the politics of Central America and Latin America. So it's during that period I encountered the music of Victor Jara and new song music, which he was the leader of. And it resonated in me for forever, you know. So it's still there. And it finally led me to, at one point, this is now 12 years ago, I've got to make a film about Victor Jara. North Americans need to know about the Woody Guthrie of South America. And that's sort of the short version of the story.
And now they can. This film actually is going to be played at Main Street Landing in Burlington on Friday, December 8th at 7:30. So people in Vermont and beyond will be able to get to know who Victor Jara was. John Suma is the producer of the documentary. It's called The Resurrection of Victor Jara. Thank you very much for talking with us, John. Yeah, you want to make a plug, right?
I just want to mention one thing. The Victor Jara website, if listeners want to go to support our Kickstarter campaign and to learn more about the film and view the trailer, there is a website, victorlives.com.
And you can get that right at vpr.net if you didn't catch that. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, 10,000 years of cheese. We take on the intersection of cheese and all aspects of human civilization with the Vermonters behind the new 900-page tome, The Oxford Companion to Cheese. Send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.